Johnson and Bill. Mr. Levine?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Minato and I represent the plaintiff appellant. This is an appeal from Judge St. Eve's granting a motion for judgment on the pleadings involving a claim for discrimination and state law claim. The basis for her decision was the doctrine of res judicata. The doctrine of res judicata does not apply in this case. The core operative facts in the federal claim is much broader in scope than the core operative facts in the state law claim. Defendant has conceded that in the filings, in the briefs, and before the district court. The core operative facts in the federal court claim encompasses all the way from 2003 to 2008. The state court claim focuses solely on 2007 and a little of 2006. They involve different units of time and space, different people making different discriminatory decisions. Defendants, if you look at Judge St. Eve's decision, there's a three lines in her sentence where she says pragmatically reviewing the complaint, and she only focuses on a few items in the complaint, such as delegating paralegal work to an attorney. She disregards the other facts that the federal complaint alleges. The defendants do exactly the same thing. They keep talking about the discriminatory act, but they forget that some of the discriminatory acts took place in 2003, from the hiring by Joseph, decision not to hire by Joseph Marconi, to discriminatory acts that took place in 2008, to discriminatory acts that took place in 2004. Defendants' argument is analogous to if two employees at Johnson & Bell were speeding and struck the plaintiff, one in 2003 and one in 2007, that somehow because they were both car accidents and the employees were speeding, that the two causes of actions are the same. Two causes of actions are not the same, and it's no different in the employment context. The Pirelli versus City of Aurora case highlights that. There's also there's the Herman versus Sencom Cable case that talks about all because two causes of actions are joined by a common contract. In this case, we have an employment contract, terminable at will. It doesn't mean that two causes of actions are similar. The second reason why res judicata doesn't apply is res judicata is a doctrine of fairness. Res judicata doesn't apply if it would be inequitable to apply res judicata. The plaintiff in this case didn't have a full and fair opportunity to litigate his case in state court, and the case of Alton versus Jones highlights that. The defendants in this case argued before the state courts in the proceedings that the plaintiff's discrimination claims are not related to his state court claims. The state courts at the state level and the appellate level adopted that description of the plaintiff's claim. So if you look at the state court decision, they characterized the plaintiff's claim in state court as an employee evaluation in 2006 and 2007. And that's why they never considered the discrimination claims. And when the plaintiff filed his claim in federal court, the defendants flip-flopped, and they argued that the plaintiff's state law lawsuit was more than the 2006 and 2007 evaluation, but encompassed his entire career at Johnson & Bell. But that's not fair. By making that argument and preventing the plaintiff from an opportunity to litigate his discrimination claims in state court, defendants cannot now turn around and take an inconsistent position and argue that argument was never made. Another reason why that shouldn't apply is judicial estoppel. Judicial estoppel prevents a party from shifting positions. Now, the defendant has cited these cases that are not applicable. The cases that they cite are where there is a state court review of a state agency. In this case, the plaintiffs made a charge of discrimination, which is required with either the EEOC or the Illinois Department of Human Rights, and he filed a charge with the Illinois Department of Human Rights. You have to do that to get your right to sue letter so you can go to federal court. The defendants in this case moved to dismiss that matter on the lack of subject matter jurisdiction. So there was never an appellate court or a state court review of the state agency decision in this matter. So the cases that are cited by the defendants are inapplicable. So having moved to dismiss the Illinois Department of Human Rights proceedings for lack of jurisdiction. Defendants seem to want to argue now that the plaintiff had an opportunity to argue his discrimination claims before the Illinois Department of Human Rights. Again, they're just flip-flopping. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. Other than that, I'll stand on my briefs and reserve my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Sean. Mr. Bowen?
May it please the court and counsel. I'm a little confused by the plaintiff's argument initially and today that there was no identity of causes of action, because in his reply brief he concedes that he did split his claims. So I have suggested to this court that the only issue before us today is whether or not he was justified in splitting his claims. The last time this case was before this court, Judge Posner asked the plaintiff if he had a reason for why he split his claims, and he basically said he didn't know better. Not knowing better is not a sufficient justification to allow the splitting of claims. What happened here is that in the state court action that was filed in 2009, there was a defamation claim and an IIED claim. In May of 2009, he amended his complaint, and then there was a motion to dismiss that was filed. That motion to dismiss was granted. Clearly, the plaintiff knew how to amend his claims, yet when the motion to dismiss was granted, he stood on his complaint and then filed a notice of appeal. A month later, his EEOC right to sue letter was issued. What the plaintiff should have done was move the Circuit Court of Cook County to stay that action to allow him to submit and file his Title VII and Section 1981 claims. But he didn't do that. There are plenty of cases that this court has issued as directly on point there. Also, plaintiff has indicated that, or argued that he was unable to file his Title VII and Section 1981 claims on the basis that there was no subject matter jurisdiction in the Circuit Court of Cook County. That's simply wrong. That issue was clarified, and Blount v. Stroud, and has been also addressed in the Dukeran case before this court, and most recently by Walchek, Judge Sykes' opinion in January of this year. He's also suggested that collateral estoppel applies, and this goes to the motion dismissed that was filed in the Circuit Court of Cook County. The last page of that motion dismissed contained a motion to strike certain allegations. That motion to strike was never ruled upon by the Circuit Court. So the Circuit Court in no way barred or prevented the plaintiff from filing his Section 1981 and Title VII claims. He was free to do so. He simply didn't do it. Instead, he decided to split his claims, but that is not permitted by the law of this court. If there's any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. John?
Splitting your claim and applying the doctrine of res judicata is not the same thing. You can split your claims. The issue is, do the claims arise out of the same group of core operative facts? And they do not. And the other thing is, when we were first up...
Perhaps you could explain why they do not out of the same operative facts.
They do not because the test for res judicata is a transaction test. It's whether the transactions arise out of the same core operative facts. And if one cooperative fax is from 2003 to 2008 and one cooperative fax is from 2006, they do not arise out of the same. In Herman, for example, the Seventh Circuit gave...
If you felt there was discrimination on a Monday and then on another one on a Friday of the same week, would your position be that that's not the same operative fax?
That may be the same operative fax, but you're talking about a week as opposed to...
What was the gap in years between the two sets, Mr. Huon?
Well, they go from 2003 all the way to 2008. The
right.
State court case just focused on 2006 and 2007. You know, an example is the one in the Herman decision where the court said the plaintiff is terminated on his way out, slips on the banana. This him slipping on the banana somehow makes it related to what happened in 2008. I don't think the employment evaluation in 2007 by partners who were not the supervisor of the plaintiff necessarily arise from the same cause of action as a different partner who declined to hire the plaintiff or the same set of facts as a strategy by Jonathan Bell to hire minority attorneys to generate business and then slowly terminate them over time. Those set of facts were much broader than what happened in 2006 or 2007. They don't arise from the same cause of facts as a white attorney that's not disciplined when a minority attorney is disciplined in other years. They don't arise from the same set of facts as when a partner in 2004 decides not to delegate work based on race, and then you're terminated in 2008. It's not like, think of the public policy you would create. An employer could get away by just, hey, you know what, let's just terminate this guy. And when we terminate him or we terminate her, everything we did during that span of time has to be brought in one lawsuit. The other thing I want to point out is in the Seventh Circuit decision, the appellate court also said that Jonathan Bell probably misled the district court. And by misleading the district court, the plaintiff's claim just sat there and languished during that time. They did the same thing in state court. They said that the discrimination claim is not relevant. Then in federal court, they said, oh, it is relevant. But the plaintiff is the master of his complaint. And by choosing to engage in a strategy of flip-flopping, in this case, the doctrine behind res judicata is to conserve judicial resources. The plaintiff did nothing here to stretch out judicial resources. He's ready for discovery. He's ready to try the case. The only person that stretched out judicial resources is the defendant. And in closing, I see my time is up. I just want to add that I took the reasonable path. The dissent in Dockery in 2013 pointed out that there was a change in the law by Blount versus in Stroud in January of 2008. The plaintiff filed his complaint in January of 2008. 5 days or a few days later, Dockery comes out with the dissent decision by Judge Hamilton. Well, in 2013, the federal jurors can disagree. How could you expect somebody who's a plaintiff back in 2009 or 2008 to engage in a different type of strategy that they're suggesting? What they're suggesting is not reasonable. The plaintiff in this case pursued the reasonable path. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Court